Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Preece. This week, former CIA officer Jonna Mendez on spy disguises in fact and fiction.
You know, a lot of that process came out of Hollywood makeup, out of John Chambers and Planet of the Apes and his half masks, where you had chimpanzees that really could emote. That's what started the mask program. When Hollywood saw our full-faced animated mask, they couldn't believe it. Almost all of the people we were working with were men. If you approach a man with a wig in your hand, you have a situation just up front. They don't want to wear that wig. They don't want to glue on a mustache. I did not write this book to write about discrimination against women. I set out to write a memoir of my career. I kind of wandered into this subject and couldn't, no matter where I turned, couldn't get away from it and had to include it.
Jonna Mendez, it's about damn time that I talk to you on Chatter. It's so nice to be with you here in person in the Goat Rodeo studio. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. I feel the same. It's been a while since we had a conversation.
Yeah, and it's been a while since I saw a new book of yours, but guess what? We've got one. And I have just heard, as we're recording this, that Amazon is featuring your new book in its highlighted memoirs and biographies section. So people will be seeing a lot of this book, not just in major media like People Magazine, which has a feature on you, but also through places that do the book selling thing, right?
Important places.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about this. It's a new book, a remarkable book that you reveal a lot more about yourself than you have in all your other writings combined, called In True Face. But I want to get people up to speed first for those few people living in caves who haven't seen you talking about espionage or haven't been to the International Spy Museum, where either you're there in person, as you are often, or featured in some of the exhibits and films and artifacts that are displayed there. So talk a little bit in a brief version about what you did as a career, and then we'll get into some of the details when we talk about the stories you tell in your book.
Well, as a career at CIA, I was in multiple places. I went in as a secretary. I was a pretty good secretary. I kind of rose quickly, and I was working for the director of my office, and I was bored to death.
Yeah.
So I ended up taking some of our training courses in Office of Technical Service in photography because I was just personally interested in photography. And I found a niche for myself in photo operations, starting out in the dark rooms, processing the take from all kinds of cameras all over the world. Segued from the darkroom piece of it to the operational piece of it, where I was actually going out and training the foreigners, working with us, providing us with the intelligence, and somebody else was developing it. And that was great.
Mm-hmm. And just to flesh that out a bit, it's really nice if Jonna can get to a place overseas that has intelligence that we need a photograph of or something related to an upcoming operation that we need a photograph of. But there are a lot of places that you can't easily get. So assets would often be doing the photography in places that we don't have access to, locked office buildings, private residences, government warehouses, things of that sort, right?
All over the place. One of our cameras that I was teaching people how to use and developing the film, it was a small Tropel. And we only issued a Tropel camera, which was concealed typically in a pen, a really expensive fountain pen that still wrote. The people we gave that one to were people that could get right up to the desk of just, for instance, say, Putin's desk. And maybe with one finger silently take a picture of the minutes of the meeting, the agenda for the meeting. That was the gold that we were that we were hoping for. But we had all kinds of cameras and all kinds of concealments, and whether it was our own officers taking the pictures or our assets, the foreigners that were working with us. It was the lifeblood of a lot of what we did, the intelligence that came out of those.
That's a great foundation, and I think every aspect of that I'll be, you know, trying to draw stories out of you to tell them. But let's go back to the beginning. You talked about coming into the agency in the secretarial pool. Describe how women were typically employed at the agency as you arrived in the late 60s. Not the lore or the rare exceptions or the old OSS stories, but the actual reality for the 90% of women who the agency hired. What were the career tracks? And then we'll talk about how you helped to shatter some of that mold.
Well, when I do this, then we start dancing around. How old am I?
29 is my understanding, but I don't go beyond that.
When I came in, it was typical for women to be hired, say, as a GS-3, GS-4. Mm-hmm. Jean Vertfe, the woman who basically helped track down Alder James and put him in prison, came in with a college degree and all kinds of background, and she was hired as a GS-3 typist. We all were hired as typists. And the goal then was to see how long it took you to get out of that and find something of substance that you could do. Mm-hmm. And almost every woman I worked with started that way and ended up in some sort of a professional career. Mm-hmm. But we didn't come in to professional careers. The men did.
Yeah. But it's fascinating because you look to the 1980s, 1990s, and of course more recently, of course you have women chiefs of station. You've had a woman director of operations. You've had chief of disguise. You've had heads of almost every division and department in the agency. But for that generation, all of those women who reached those positions started as typists or secretaries, with very few exceptions.
That's absolutely true. Because we were a technical office, if you came in with technical credentials, if you were a chemist with the background that we needed, or if you were an engineer and had all the training, you would not be starting as a secretary. You'd be starting at the lowest grade of engineer or chemist that they could find. But they would hire you into your technical specialty. But most people, say the analysts, the operations officers, we started really low.
Yeah. But there was an exception. There's a woman that you write about that is worth mentioning, Eloise Page. Mm. Talk a little bit about Eloise.
You know, I discovered her while I was a secretary. I ended up actually meeting Eloise at Dick Helms. I think it was his 80th birthday. I sat next to her.
The former CIA director.
Mm-hmm. She sat there all very prim and proper, and she had her purse. It was like the queen's purse. It was that shape.
Maybe it was the queen's purse.
She was a queen. It was sitting on the floor, and her white gloves were lying on top of her purse. And I looked at her. I actually, I got tears in my eyes. She was just such a woman. But she was Bill Donovan's secretary. And he was the founder of the OSS. And then she was.
So back when he was running the Office of Strategic Services, she was working directly with him.
At the very beginning of the intelligence community. Then she was his administrative assistant. And she worked her way into an overseas assignment. This was during the World War II period. And she ended up being the chief of station in Athens. Mm-hmm. She was the highest ranking woman in the intelligence community, certainly the highest paid. Mm. And I thought, well, there's my role model. Yeah. I want to be like Eloise.
Yeah.
She was, I guess, a ball of fire. But I asked some of the men early on when I discovered Eloise's career track and I was interested. I asked a couple of the men in the Directorate of Operations, and they would say, like, oh, that old battle axe.
Mm.
They didn't have a lot of respect for her, for what she had done.
Yeah.
I think they thought she was intruding.
Of course. The culture then, it's hard to talk to people in the office culture there now. You can't understand it. It's a totally different world than it was at that point. And yet, what strikes me in getting details of your story in the book that even I haven't heard from you before is during your career, there were always men, because they were in the positions of leadership universally, I think, early on, there were always some men who were allies, who helped you, who gave you opportunities. Now, that's not to say, oh, good on the men there, because overall that was fighting against the dominant culture, which was no help at all, in fact, quite the opposite. But it was nice to see that some people got it. And we'll get to a guy, one of them named Tony, that comes up later. But at the beginning, you were – what, about a 2-year climb in the secretarial pool in OTS, the Office of Technical Services, to get to the front office. And then once you were in the front office, you did have one of those quasi-allies, somebody who said, maybe you can take some courses that would get you beyond what you're doing now. And that's when you started taking the photography courses. How did that happen? And what do you think you would have done if you hadn't gotten into those photo courses?
Well, it all started. I called my boss out to the outer office where I worked, and we had quite a view. We were on Navy Hill, which is just across from State Department. And you could get the horizon of the mall, and you could see the turrets of the Smithsonian Castle building. And I had my boss come out, and I said, you know the castle, the Smithsonian? I said, I have this feeling that there's a job for me down there because there's nowhere for me to go here. Hmm. I was at a dead end secretarially. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm thinking about going and talking to them. And this man, David Brandwine, he was a wonderful director of OTS. He said, well, you could do that. Or he said, you know, you could take some of our photo courses, which were reserved for Directorate of Operations case officers. They weren't made available to us technical officers. He said, take some of those. You know, you've got time on your hands. You can only do one New York Times crossword puzzle a day.
So how did you get in? Did you sneak in or did he pull a lever and find a way to approve it?
He pulled a lever and I got to take the panoply of these courses that were unique photo courses. Mm-hmm. For instance, the first one I took, mm-hmm. was called Airborne Platforms.
Ooh.
And it was, they gave me a long, long lens, like a 200-millimeter lens. This is old film camera terminology.
Yeah.
And gave me an airplane, well, and a pilot. And I was in a harness in the back, and the pilots, I had a mic on. And my job was to see if I could stabilize those images, if I could take a picture of that truck on a dirt road kicking up dust or geese. We flew with some geese. It was a day. I will never, ever forget that day. It was glorious. Mm. And I could do all of those things. And then you just, okay, what's the next course?
Yeah.
And I took almost all of them.
So when you say you took photography courses, we need to get out of the mindset that this is like, you know, going to the local community center and taking a photography course. This is, yes, you took courses in film technology and processing, but also some things like airborne photography that you're not going to get at your community center.
Or how to take a flash photo in the dark.
Ooh.
How to put a filter over your flash where there is no flash to the visible eye. Just all kinds of tricks and hyperfocal distances, how to walk out with a camera that everything's going to be in focus. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to be fiddling with the lenses. Just all the ways that we manipulated cameras to get what we needed.
Did you have an artistic bent growing up? Were you interested in art, photography, anything like that before that?
I was an avid amateur photographer. And there was a point when I went over to our disguise people, the chief of that group at the time, Tony Mendez, early in my career. And I said, I'm interested in what are your entry requirements to come over into a professional position over here. I did not follow that up because the photography thing kind of took hold of me.
Yeah.
But I had done some exploratory conversations over there. I knew that I didn't want to remain a secretary in that office, in that place. I was going to die. I needed another job.
So once you're in the photography classes, it's not just photography. And I say just photography as if it's limiting, but you've just described how it's quite expansive. But you were getting introduced eventually to things like micro dots and secret writing and other chemistry-based technology, moving well beyond what people imagine when you say, well, I just picked up a camera and took some photos. This was getting into some, what at the time and in a few cases probably even now, are some advanced techniques.
Yeah, it was all considered clandestine imaging in the larger picture, and so you could you could justify having secret writing, which was actually an incredible tool.
Yeah.
Microdots were just another form of photography. We just turned the full frame picture into a little tiny thing about the size of a period at the end of a sentence in a major magazine.
Yeah.
And that's how we would send them back and forth. Mm-hmm. These skills all swirled around the exchange of information. How do you clandestinely exchange it, whether it's on film, whether it's on paper, whatever it is?
There's something I heard years ago. You may recall this, and maybe it's apocryphal, that they declassified something, and I'm guessing it was about 10 or 15 years ago, that the government declassified something that at the time was the oldest remaining classified issue, even before our formal classification system started. And it was an invisible ink recipe or something like that from 1917, if I recall. So there's some history to this, right? But that also shows that the technology, we have so many advanced technologies that we think this stuff is archaic, and you might as well be going back to Elizabethan England if you're talking about secret writing. But guess what? It works for a reason, and we preserved that secret for presumably 75 or 100 years.
People tend to think that secret writing is lemon juice and your mother's iron. I mean, that's what most people, if they haven't experienced, that would be their experience. Our chemists were putting together systems that they were unbreakable and undetectable. Mm-hmm. You could only develop a message, that message, with a particular formula or a particular product, whatever it was, mm-hmm. it's the only thing that would work. Then we would train a foreign person in how to do the secret writing, how to develop what we were sending to them. Mm-hmm. Then whatever the developer was, we had to issue the developer to that person. Typically, he has to go through his country's controls. Mm-hmm. So we had to disguise the developer. So for instance, I remember one gentleman that went back to his country with a package that looked like from CVS. There wasn't even a CVS back then. A blister pack of pills. Mm. It was dog worming medicine.
How nice.
That's what the box said.
Yeah.
The instructions were there. He had a dog, but it wasn't dog worming medicine. It was the developer for his secret writing.
Brilliant.
From us.
Because what customs official wants to go into the deworming medicine to verify it?
Yeah, and we figured nobody's going to say to you as you're coming through immigration, well, just take one of those pills. Let's just check. Because we didn't want it to be something that they could test that way.
That's a fair point. Talk about the Career Development Program, or CDP as it was acronymized at the time, because it was a program that, if I understand right, perhaps only one other woman had ever been put into it. And after a few years of doing this kind of work, there's Jana about to go into the career development program. What was it and how did you get into it?
You know, I always think back on my career. Mm-hmm. I think that I was lucky. I think I was lucky multiple times, which starts looking suspicious, but I was lucky. I was lucky that I was stopped when I was in Europe. Our office deputy director was walking through. I didn't even know he was in town. He said, so what are you going to do when you get home? What do you have in mind? And I didn't have anything in mind. And I simply said, I'd like to be in that program where there was only one woman that I knew of who had graduated from it. Hmm. And by golly, they put me in that program. It was a very selective process. There were eight of us. It lasted a year. And they took you away from your normal duties and they taught you all the things that my office could do, my larger office, how to install an audio bug, how to it just went on and on. A little bit of engineering, how to fabricate a concealment device, how to troubleshoot an electronic communications piece of equipment that might have a problem. We learned a lot about a lot of things, and we also learned when to recognize that, okay, this is not something you send for a specialist. Mm-hmm. So if you end up somewhere on the far side of the earth and you're looking at an electronic communication device on the roof of a building that has stopped communicating, mm-hmm. You can try and fix it or you can call the techs in. So I was in Europe and that happened and I was up on a roof And I looked at this thing. It was in a flower pot on a roof that you could never...
Good disguise.
You couldn't move it.
Yeah.
And it was communicating into our office. You called it a cutout device. Anyway, there was nothing I could do, and I knew that. And I had to call the techs, and I knew that. So what did I do? I kicked it. And I think I almost sprained my ankle. I just gave it up. A kick.
Out of frustration.
I thought, okay, so I'll go back, and I'll talk to the chief of station, and I'll say, we have to get the audio guys in. Mm-hmm. I cannot deal with this. And by the time I got back to the office, they were saying, oh, it's working. I fixed it.
The magic heel.
And this was one of my important lessons. Luck over skill. Anytime.
Well, I'd have to say your luck probably improves the more skills you've developed.
This is true.
Sometimes it's a kick in the right place. Sometimes it's a flower pot. Sometimes it's someone's ass. But you need to put a good kick somewhere once in a while in
a
career.
Exactly. That's well put.
That's awesome. So the career development program wasn't really about leadership or management skills. It really was about all the tools of the trade across this wide office.
It meant that if you showed up at some CIA station, you were capable of solving a multitude of problems for them. You weren't a one-man band, not a full-fledged one-man band, but you brought a number of capabilities when you came through the door. And and to my office, that was valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your new book, you talk about your personal relationships much more than you've opened up about before in print, including your first husband, John. Was that hard to open up and write that? That's a little bit different than writing about the Moscow rules of operational tradecraft or, you know, Argo or other things that are more tactical and practical work issues. You're showing a lot more about yourself.
You know, I wrote this during COVID. I mean, the first big draft of this was during COVID, and it probably because it was COVID was why I was writing it. You can only do so many of those little jigsaw puzzles. You have to expand your horizons there. I had written about that marriage a little bit in a book called Spy Dust.
Yeah. There's a window definitely into it.
Yeah. But. It was hard to write it because basically what I'm writing about is how my marriage broke up, and how I immediately formed another relationship. It's a little tricky, but no, I thought, you know, the people that know me know that story, and people that are not my good friends, maybe they'll read it and recognize something of themselves in it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it really does make the stories about the work missions, it gives them a real depth because you understand the emotions, not just with John in these early cases, but also with your family and the fact that, you know, your family knew you were off doing things, but of course they couldn't know everything you were doing. You weren't teaching them the advanced technology you were learning. But yet you had some family commitments and things that you were quite concerned about over the years. That makes this a very human, emotional book in so many ways.
That's kind of nice to hear. I'm too close to it, so I don't know how the public or how my friends will react to it. But it also, the personal piece of it started happening the first time I went back to the States and went back to my friends that I'd left in Wichita, Kansas. And got 3 minutes of, so how is it in Europe, and do you like the food, and this and that. And then there was just like this line. They really didn't want any more than that. They wanted to tell me about Wichita. Of course they did.
What they've been up to. Yeah.
And I sat there and listened to all my friends who had gotten married and gotten divorced and had children. And I thought, you know, there's this gap now where these friendships are going to wither because that common element is gone.
Yeah. But of course, you form new friendships
through
the work at the agency, too.
Yeah.
And some of them become, well, they change relationships over time. One of your, I would say, friend, ally was Tony Mendez.
Absolutely.
Describe, to the best of your memory, how you first met him and your intersections over the years until he ended up running, I believe it was the Graphics and Identity Transformation Group and your movement into that work.
I first met him in the Far East at a CIA station Christmas party. And it was a big station. We had some of our chemists were assigned there, and they made the punch that year. a punch that was PNG'd for all times. I don't know what the recipe was, but I think everyone at that party got drunk. Tony got terribly drunk that day. That's when I met him. And he fell down the stairs in the embassy to the lobby. Oh, it was terrible. He never, the rest of his career, ever went to a Christmas party again.
Wow. Was he actually injured?
No, but
oh, good. He rolled through it.
He said there was a rubber coating on the stairs going down to the lobby. It probably saved his life, is what he said.
Yeah.
So it was not a great first impression that he made on me. But he was always kind of out there. I never was working directly with him. Mm-hmm. I knew about him. Over all the years, I was assigned here. He was assigned there. I met his wife. I knew Karen, a wife that he lost her to cancer some years later. Yeah. But he was never in our social circle, so to say, of overseas. It wasn't until then I met him when I was inquiring about maybe going into disguise and what were the requirements. I had a talk with him then, and I went away thinking, I don't think that's going to work out. And it wasn't really until John and I, we wanted to go overseas and we wanted a dual assignment.
Yeah.
And this goes back to that thing about working women that keeps popping up in my book.
Tandem assignments back then usually meant congratulations, you're now the secretary
chief. You're going to be a secretary again, dear, no matter what you have done in the meantime. But when that happened, there was something else going on at CIA, and that was that a lot of the wives of CIA officers had their own work and their own careers going in Washington, D.C., and then their husband would get this plum assignment somewhere, and the wives would say, hell no, I'm not leaving this wonderful job I have to go be your wife in some, I don't know, wherever it is. So the wives started speaking up, and the CIA started having a little bit of a problem filling some slots. They established a committee on working tandem couples, and I ended up being the S&T representative.
S&T.
The Science and Technology Directorate. That's where my office lived. Mm-hmm. I was one of multiple people, and it was very straightforward. We simply fixed it. That committee fixed it, and they said, for agency wives, no matter what job, you're going to get up and go with your husband and leave that great assignment that you have. When you come back, you will get either that job or a similar job and a similar grade. And it took all the sting out of that that tandem thing. When that was going on, I went over and talked to Tony because John and I wanted a tandem assignment. And he was so close to the operations directorate that he went over and sealed a deal for us to go.
I don't think you can say exactly where if it didn't get through the publication review board, but you can say it was not in the United States.
It was not. It was in the Far East.
Very good. Very good.
So the agreement, it was in writing. It said even if the two office directors, even if they got moved out of their assignments, this deal would stand.
Wow.
John was in security. I was in science and technology. And so we had this wonderful tandem assignment. But Tony was the only person that I knew that could engineer an agreement like that. And he did that. Yeah. And he was known in our office for taking care of the women on his staff, for seeing that assignments that were earned were given. Mm-hmm. He was, if you were one of the females in that group, you were aware that he was there and that he was looking out for you.
And that's something that people who are aware of his career and some of the things that were later publicized about his work, they don't realize that some of his biggest impact in the agency was not the wonderful things for which he got Trailblazers awards and things, but he was a career development officer. He actually helped bring people up at a time when it was really important for a huge section of the workforce.
Yeah, it's a... And he's a painter on the side. If I sat here and made the list of all the things that Tony Mendez was, I'd probably start crying.
Yeah.
He was quite a guy.
So eventually, despite your initial skepticism with identity transformation and graphics and masks, you ended up working in that area. How did you get into that area, and what did you think? Because that is slightly different than some of the things you'd been doing up to that point.
It's entirely different, and it was... It was after I finished the book and looked back at it, I thought, you know, if I made a line diagram of my career, it's some zigzags all the way through. And the biggest zigzag was to go from photography to disguise. Mm-hmm. To take that assignment that I wanted, this was the next assignment. I spent a summer working in the subcontinent and came home and said, I would like an assignment there. I would like to live there. And that would be my home base. And they looked and they said, well, there are no photo jobs opening up in your timeline. The only thing that's coming up is a disguise job. And I said, well, I could learn
that. Happen.
Train me.
Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah.
They actually took almost 2 years. And you're like, well, what? You have to cut a wig and you have to have some glasses and there's so much to disguise. It really was a very, very detailed, and the training was arduous.
Talk about that a little bit. There are some things that even now I know you still can't get into because even some of the things that were being worked on then are still in use today. But to the extent you can, share some details about the wide range of things you had to learn to do effective disguise.
Whenever I go to the dentist today, a thing that I just hate to do, but when I'm at the dentist and if they're doing a dental impression, or I say to them, you know, I used to do that. Mm-hmm. I used to use the same tools, the same materials, the same alginate. So we did dental impressions.
Yeah.
We did optical. We were making glasses for people who were overseas, and we could make bifocals. You have to do all the things that an optician does, except you're doing them in a CIA office. The hair goods, we had suppliers overseas, and we had to go to their location and teach them exactly what we needed because our hair goods, we couldn't buy them off the shelf. Mm-hmm. They would be tailored specifically to an individual. Mm-hmm. Everything we did. If we were working on a quick change disguise scenario, we needed all the sizes. Basically, our goal was to be able to recreate you without you being in the room. We could like build another you.
Yeah.
We knew your sizes. We knew your pupil distance in your eyes. We knew the size of your head. We knew everything about you. And we'd put in a little file. We'd have photographs of you from all different points of view. Then we went out to Hollywood and we worked with people out there and some of the things that they did. And on the side, we were working with the magic community in ways to fool the eye, deception and illusion. That's their business, but was our business too.
That's what was fascinating in talking with you years ago about this is everybody focuses on, you know, the mask, the hair, the... you know, kind of the Mission Impossible idea of just the change in the face. But so much of it is psychology. And whether you're working with experts, and magicians are basically, you know, social psychology experts and experts of perception. But you have to get to learn that too. So it's not just the skill of how do you weave together this kind of hair for this kind of identity transformation, but you have to be thinking about angles and about movements and about perceptions and distractions and dissimulations in order for that to work.
And then you have to train the person that you're disguising to carry it off.
Is that the really hard part?
That could be hard. You have to realize that most of the people we were working with, almost all of the people we were working with were men, not women, because we didn't have really any women case officers back then, very few. So it was men. If you approach a man with a wig in your hand, you have a situation just up front. They don't want to wear that wig. They don't want to glue on a mustache. They don't want. Current events helped things along. Once we started dealing with terrorism and narcotics, counter-narcotics, all of a sudden, these materials that would allow you to disappear from view became a form of body armor. They would protect you from people with guns. They might keep you from getting shot in downtown Bogota because you look like a gringo and you didn't look like one of them. Then it took on a whole different approach. We used to have people that would walk into American embassies, come into They had to get by the gate guards. They'd end up maybe at post one saying, I want to talk to an American intelligence officer. Well, there's a protocol. Somebody has to go down mm-hmm. and talk to those people. Guess what? They went in disguise.
Yeah.
This is after terrorism, after all of that really picked up speed, because there was a fair amount of people coming in off the street just wanting to know, well, who's in there? And if I wait for them when they come out at the end of the day and follow them home, I wonder where they live.
Yeah.
And if they have a wife and kids. So they took it a lot more seriously as they should.
And not just terrorism, but foreign intelligence services, right? Try to see who the person is who you bring in to do the screening of somebody who says they have an intelligence source.
All of it, yeah.
But you don't want that person to be identified as one of the intel people. So disguises make sense even in a very controlled setting, much less out on the street where there's, in a sense, fuller scrutiny.
So the way we would sell it to the male case officer that came in for the disguise scenario is we'd put everything, we'd see him a couple of times, and then we'd have a final fitting. This is what you'll look like. So how does it feel? And they would all say, feels great. I like this. This is good. Thank you. Thank you very much. And they're getting ready to leave, and you go, no, hold on. What we want you to do is go down to the cafeteria mm-hmm. at lunch. Mm-hmm. And we scheduled these around lunch. Just go down, wear your disguise, go through the line, get your meal. Just wear it in public. Just see how you feel. And they always, I don't ever remember one of them coming back other than enthusiastic, saying, my boss was there. He was at the next table.
That's great.
They were stunned. And so then you had some confidence that if they needed it, they would use it.
Absolutely.
Without that initial trying on period, you never knew.
You played a key role in developing and advancing what we called the semi-animated masks, or SAMs. There are some details of that you can talk about more than you could even a few years ago. I remember when I talked to you for my first book, and you talked about your mask use, even up to and including the Oval Office. There were some things you couldn't talk about, but you can share some of the ideas and fundamental technology. So what is a semi-animated mask, and why is it so useful?
A semi-animated mask was a half mask. Mm-hmm. And the semi-animation meant that your mouth, it was really your mouth. The mask would stop somewhere in the middle of your cheeks. There would be mm-hmm. some hair goods. There would be some kind of a beard, maybe a mustache. There would be a wig. But you could put this thing on very quickly, put it on, take it off, and you could have a conversation. You couldn't get right up to it. You would start seeing that the forehead, that the eyes, that it wasn't moving like it maybe should have.
But from a reasonable distance, really effective.
It was really effective. We used that and the whole time we were using it, we were trying to develop a full face mask that would animate. That was the gold standard, and we developed it. Now we had a couple of our people at headquarters who were working our end of it. Then we had a contractor who was working his end of it. He had a full up lab. He was a scientist, keeping notes and doing experiments and writing everything down. We were a lot more loose in our pursuit of this mm-hmm. holy grail. But we got there, and we produced these masks that were just incredible. I was chief of disguise when we really produced them. The first one, we were going to take it to the White House, but we burned it up in an oven instead. It malfunctioned overnight. We had to, you know what burning tires smell like?
Oh, no.
You'd walk into our office, and you couldn't be there because it was just reeking. It was that mask. So they did it again. And then we had a capability that we had never had before. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that process came out of Hollywood, out of Hollywood makeup, out of John Chambers and Planet of the Apes and his half masks where you had chimpanzees that really could emote and be expressive. That's what started the mask program. When Hollywood saw our full-faced animated mask, they couldn't believe it. They didn't need to do that because by that point, they could do it with CGI.
Yeah, in post, they can take it up. Yeah.
They could create a thing that didn't exist.
Yeah.
We needed the real object, the real hardscape.
So people may have had a preview of this story elsewhere, but I think you really should share the story of how it was you went from trying one of these on yourself to suddenly being in the Oval Office with a president of the United States showing off a disguise. Tell that story.
It was George H.W. Bush was president. And he had at one point been the head of CIA, mm-hmm. the director. While he was the director, we had given him some disguises. So we had some photos. So I made a little file of photos of him in his disguises. We had just created, really, I think it was the first full face mask. I was African American. I had gloves that went with it. I wasn't handsome, but you know, it worked. Mm-hmm. And I showed it to my office director, Frank Anderson. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, my God, this is so cool. We have to show it to the head of CIA. That was Bill Webster. Hmm. So we took it to DCI Webster. He liked it a lot. Hmm. I mean, it was phenomenal. And he said, well, we're going to the White House. And I said, maybe not with a black male, because there are all these barriers for me. I don't sound like an African-American male. I don't really walk like one. Hmm. Why don't we do another one? Why don't we make me a different female? That's what we did.
Okay.
Different hair, different skin, different everything. And so I became Becky, was the name of the mask. And she was quite pretty. She had fabulous hair. I kind of loved this mask. I never wore it home or anything, but I liked this mask.
It must have been tempting.
It was tempting. And we took it to the White House, and we went right through Secret Service, and we got stuck outside of the Oval Office.
It probably helped to get through Secret Service that you're with Judge Webster, right? So he can kind of just, they wave you through because they trust that he's going to be with people that are trustworthy.
I asked Judge Webster, I said, I have no ID. He said, just hang on to my coattails.
Yep.
Not going to be a problem.
There you go.
Yeah, and it was, I was the first one to brief. And they introduced me as chief of disguise. I showed the president a folder of him in various disguises. And there's a photograph of him. He's looking at those pictures. He's laughing because, I mean, everybody does that. Oh, God, that was so cool. That was fun. And then I said, so I'm here to show you the latest. I said, so I'll take it off and you can take a look. And I started to peel it off. And he said, well, hold on. Just a minute. And he got up and he doesn't even know what he's looking for, but he's just looking to see.
He gets up from behind the desk and walks around.
Like, did I have a fake nose on? He didn't. He wanted to see if he could. He only spent a moment. It was like, okay. He sat back down. He said, now, do it. And I peeled it off. And I always tell people about John Sununu.
The chief of staff, right?
He was sitting next to me. We were like in a horseshoe and I was on the far right and he was next to me. And he had a little notepad and a pencil, and he was going to go after me. So I was the first one to brief. He was next. So he's making notes while I'm talking. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I would have been doing the same. Making notes. He crossed it out, and he made another note. And when he looked up, I was holding my face in my hand with the hair. There's a great picture somewhere. Yeah. It was this moment. And so, and there were pictures because there was a photographer in there.
Yeah.
The White House photographer.
The photographer captured it.
I used to want that job. That used to be a career goal. I thought I would like to do that job. Anyway, I was the first one out. I went out to the outer office. There's a secretary out there. Their dog, Millie, was out there. Mm-hmm. Her puppies were out there. So I'm playing with puppies. Photographer comes out. She said, excuse me, what was that? I said, I think you photographed it because you could hear the shutter in her 35 millimeter camera.
Yeah.
I think you photographed it. She said, yeah, but what was that? And I said, I can't tell you. It's classified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it took her 10 years to send me the picture.
Yeah. I remember you got me the airbrushed version of that where you're clearly holding something up in the air or it looks like you're just gesticulating wildly.
It does.
You got your hand up in the air like you're making some great point. You're actually holding the device, but it's been airbrushed out of the actual photograph, so we can't see what actually made that scene memorable.
I used to joke and say she was really ticked off at me because I was maybe a little short with her. You photographed it.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, I had all these people that would come through my office. You know, you have your little wall where all your certificates and things are. People would say, what was that?
Yeah.
What were you saying? What were you telling him? Yeah. And I would say it's classified. You can't talk about her.
It's also just very cool that, first of all, by now you're chief of disguise, and we'll walk back a little bit to get there. But you're chief of disguise. You are a woman in that role, which is memorable. Analysts go in to brief presidents, some presidents more than others. But George H.W. Bush had plenty of briefings from agency officers. Operations officers, less often, but will go in and brief presidents. But OTS officers going in to meet with presidents, not nearly as common. Happens for various reasons, but not nearly as often. And there you are having that moment and being able to show people that now you're leading, hey, guess what? We get to do cool stuff like this in Washington, not just overseas.
Three OTS officers went into the Oval Office that we knew of, and it was three. Mm-hmm. Dr. Crown was one. It was a unique situation. Tony Mendez was the second one. Mm-hmm. I was the third one. Mm-hmm. Now, there may have been more. Who knows?
Right. But at that point.
Yeah. it was a place of honor.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned being chief of disguise, and I seem to recall that earlier you'd been – obviously, you were a deputy chief, but you had been offered the deputy chief of disguise, and you were hesitant to take it. Why is that?
It's a little personal tick that I have, mm-hmm. in that running the thing was never my goal. Mm-hmm. And professionally, that's probably something you can be criticized for. It just wasn't my goal. Yeah. And I thought, I'll get bogged down in finance meetings and program calls and all this. Yeah. I don't want to do that. I like the hands-on piece of it. I like working mm-hmm. with the people overseas. Yeah. I like going out. I had a trip to China. It was what? It was 2 weeks long just to really get the lay of the land. This was after China was open and we could work there, but what is there to work with? Looking at, you know, what do their bicycles look like? Yeah. Can we make a collapsible bicycle? Can we, how are we going to work in that environment? I love doing that kind of work.
Yeah,
I didn't know that I wanted to be sitting behind a desk.
Yeah, meetings and meetings and meetings.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but you did it.
But I did it.
What were the joys of that job that you perhaps didn't expect?
The joys were in disguise at some point way before me, before Tony. I think Tony started this. Disguise was not so highly thought of. People did think it's glasses and wigs and like I don't even need that. I'm not going to use that. Mm-hmm. Again, it's always guys. Mm-hmm. Part of the joy of the job was watching it transform on the one hand, as the operational climate got more dangerous on the other. I'm sorry about the danger that was out there with the drugs and the terrorism, but it did cause disguise to come up as a tool that was a significant tool that could make a difference, that it was something truly worth doing.
Yeah.
Those things happened at the same time, and it was a good time to be trying to bring your programs up, because it's a battle for budget. It's a battle for resources inside that bureaucracy, and we were able to bring resources to our programs.
Sure. So before moving into that leadership position as chief of disguise, you were part of a class which I had not been familiar with before, but it was run due to a very specific reason, and it was not entirely a positive thing in the way it happened. And this was the reality and perception class.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about why there was a reality and perception class, who took it, and how it struck you.
Well, it's a kind of twisted project. The theory was it was put together by a woman named Jinx Anderson, who was well thought of. She was a woman who was looking at women's roles in government and trying to help make some adjustments. So she had thought that women were not thriving because we didn't really understand the man's world that we were in. And she thought by getting a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant, this little rooster of a man who was a dear man, I have to say, and he meant well.
But
his job was to teach us how to thrive in the man's world that we found ourselves in. So So we started in Williamsburg. It was a 2-week course. We were going to be in a motel down there. It was all women and the gunnery sergeant, the gunny. Yeah. And we checked in of an evening, and in the middle of the night, the first night, pouring down rain, there's this bang, bang, bang on your door, and you could hear it going down. This is a motel. Bang, bang, bang. Get up, get up, get out, get up. And all these women, we open the doors and we go out, and he said, "I'm going to teach you how to march, ladies."
He was doing it like boot camp.
It was Paris Island.
Yeah.
In Williamsburg. And that was the beginning. His rules, no makeup, no perfume, no jewelry, no, none of that. He wanted just, you know, gym shorts and T-shirts and sneakers, and he's going to teach us how to get along with men. And then they called in men from all different professions. One of them was from the, it was like a college university at sea. What was it called? I can't. One was an Air Force general.
Okay.
And they talked to us about the women that worked for them and how they managed their women.
Oh.
The Air Force general said one of his line staff officers, her daughter almost died in a car accident, brain injuries. Mm. The daughter was never going to be okay. Mm-hmm. The woman who worked for him was never going to be okay either because her daughter was in this situation. So he parked her over here in this dead-end job, he said, where she still had her job, but some space where she could take care of her daughter. We sat and listened to this stuff. I remember the gunny. We had a couple of volleyball afternoons, and after the first episode, mm-hmm. the losers went to the other side of the net to shake hands with the winners. The gunny said, no, none of that. You don't shake their hands. Yeah. So it was an effort to teach us how to adjust our brains and come around to the men's way of doing things and yeah. recognize it and accept it. And at the end of it, you just wondered.
It's the whole story is cringeworthy. Like it's hard to believe, even well-intentioned, that people in an approval chain said, "Yeah, this is what we need to do. We need to try to teach them to be, in some cases, the worst of what men are doing." So how did the course end?
Well, at the end, toward the end, he had us marching through the day. This is Colonial Williamsburg. This is a tourist town. And this group of women, we were marching to a cadence, like, hut, two, three, four, about, you know. And we actually got very good. We weren't the Rockettes, but we were good. And so toward the end, at the very end, actually, we had kind of a graduation march through town with flags. And he put me at the front because I had done so well. He said, "You got to lead this whole thing." So I went back to my room. I put on all the jewelry I had bought. Oh, I put on all the makeup that I had. Mm-hmm. I led the parade, and I was so sorry that I was in front because I couldn't see the team behind me, and I couldn't admire. I always liked looking at how good we were at marching. Mm. So I don't know what they taught us. I don't think they taught us anything.
Well, they taught you that that's a course when you're in a leadership position that you don't want to continue, at a minimum.
They stopped it.
I'm assuming that you did not, when you were chief of disguise, try to recreate such a course officers working for you.
But it was a CIA kind of a fumble, an attempt. They didn't know quite what was wrong, but they thought maybe this would fix it.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the first time there have been attempts to correct it, but sometimes in the larger issue of the women workforce at CIA, it's actually come to lawsuits, right? There was the famous case of, was it Jeanine Bruckner?
Yeah.
I think I have the name right. I'm sorry if I
don't. Jeanine Bruckner.
Yeah, and Bruckner. And then eventually in the 1990s, a group of DO women, Directorate of Operations women, suing because of denied promotions and power. So yeah, maybe some misplaced courses, certainly still some misplaced procedures and policies that led to literally people having to sue to get what was rightfully theirs.
Each one of those instances resulted in improving the system that they were part of. I don't think any of them actually fixed it.
Right.
It's a slow fix.
Right. So there you are as Chief of Disguise, and you're spending more of your time doing management and leadership than you are with your hands in everything. You ultimately decided to retire, and I'm curious, how tough was that process? Because it seems like it should have been really difficult given all the wonderful things you've done, but it almost seems like you turned a corner that you realized, I'm not going to get to do all the fun stuff anymore.
Well, my retirement was not planned. Mm-hmm. Tony retired before I did. Mm-hmm. Tony left the CIA. They opened a window.
We should probably update the story with Tony, by the way, because by the time this happened and Tony is retiring, what was your relationship with Tony?
Oh, my. How to put this into this conversation. While I was Chief of Disguise, toward the end of my tenure there, my marriage started kind of breaking up. Mm-hmm. And while I'd been married to John Gaiser for 23 years, mm-hmm. it just wasn't really working anymore. We were going two different directions. It was clear to me that was not the situation that I wanted to spend the rest of my life in.
Right.
At the same time, kind of concurrently, Tony Mendez and I started working more and more together, more mm-hmm. and more on the Moscow problems. Mm-hmm. We had a huge surveillance team. We would take it out at night. We would run Moscow-bound officers with our surveillance team mm-hmm. as training exercises. And so I became very caught up in that. And my husband and I ended up getting divorced.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened? Then I started dating Tony Mendez, and he said very early, this won't work. He said, this is inappropriate because I'm two levels up your boss.
Mm.
And that chain of command thing, he said, I'll look and see if I can't move. He was so uniquely skilled that there wasn't any place for him to go. And then the White House said they put together an early retirement program at CIA.
Right.
Didn't matter how many years you'd been there. Didn't matter your age. But there were some qualifications. And if you met the qualifications, you could go. So Tony retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what if we stop dating and you find yourself out there at the end of
yep.
the road? So he retired. And then sometime later, we got married.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's retired and he's painting. He's always an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was working, he was an artist. So he's painting and I'm still working, and I planned on working a good long while.
Mm-hmm.
This gets tricky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I got pregnant.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I can still work. And Tony's home. We could make this work. And so after our son Jesse was born, I lasted 4 months when they opened another window. And they said, we don't care how old you are or how many or your age or, mm-hmm. or how many years you've worked. We don't care. If you could dance on the head of this pin, mm-hmm. and I could,
mm-hmm.
they said full retirement. And yeah. I retired.
Jump.
So Tony and I looked up. This is like slightly less than 2 years after we were married, and we were both
yeah.
retired.
Yeah.
This was sudden, and it was quick, and it was a jolt because the CIA had been our lives, both of
mm-hmm.
us. We were both really committed to the work we were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we were both over here.
Yeah.
You know, when you leave CIA, there's this huge door that clangs shut behind you. And now you're on the outside. And I mean, you're really on the outside. And so all your friends that you've cultivated over all these years, they're on the inside. And you discover that the ties that bind you, it doesn't work very well if you're not working together. As a matter of fact, at my old office, our retirement, the men that retired from our office had a very short lifespan, average lifespan. They would
yeah.
have heart attacks because they
yeah.
were
yeah.
so involved in the work. But what we found out, because Tony was an artist and he had a big art studio and he had huge shows twice a year, while we couldn't go in to see our friends, they could come out and visit us. So we were able to stay connected that way, and that was kind of interesting. But but we thought we were done with it. He was painting.
Right.
I was doing fine art photography. His grown son was a sculptor. That was the art studio. That was the art shows. And I thought, well, I'm going to be a mom. I'm going to learn about karate, and I'm that's great. I can do that. This will be a whole new world. And we thought we had stepped away from the whole spy thing, but we had not.
You get pulled back in a different way, right?
Yeah. Well, we started teaching. David Major set up CI Center.
Former FBI.
Former FBI. Just he was very involved in the intelligence community. He got a lot of good people to come in and do some of the training that had been internal training at CIA. Now they were outsourcing it. I thought the quality of the training was way improved. So we did some of that. And then we started working independent of him. We were doing training at DIA. And this thing just grew and grew and grew. And then Keith Melton called us and said, we're putting together an international spy museum in D.C., and we think we want Tony to come down and help us organize this massive project. They had all the artifacts. Keith Melton had tons of artifacts. But they had to be organized and into some way that made sense. So Tony went down for about 3 months and met with them. They called it charrettes. They're putting together, we could do this, we could do that. Then Tony, the man who had always supported women in his career, said, why don't you ask my wife to come down too? And Tony and I both became founding board members of the Spy Museum.
Yeah.
And from then until now, the Spy Museum has been our special project.
It has served a remarkable educational function, not just an entertaining function, which is part of it too, but an amazing informational function for so many people who otherwise would only get it from pop culture. And we both know how mixed pop culture is in accurately representing the business of espionage.
I think you put your finger on it, because I thought of it initially as an entertainment that people will walk through and they'll go, oh my God, look at that. That's fun. But because Mr. Maltz, who funded it and founded it, because he hired actual museum curators, museum people, to put together his museum, it has turned into an educational hub. And they teach classes, and they're in classrooms. And during COVID, they were in hospitals with robots going to visit little kids. There are programs every night.
Right.
Something's going on. They deal with the autistic community. They're everywhere, and it's nothing but good for the intelligence community.
And I would suggest that it's also, and disclaimer here, both of us, you know, do volunteer work and other work with the Spy Museum to help out their efforts. But I will say that the museum has improved in its newest incarnation in the new building in L'Enfant, because, you know, the entertainment side, that's always a part of it because the inherent nature of the work. The old museum, if you remember, had that touch screen where you could walk through and you could walk up to it and I believe touch it, and then the shark jumped at you and the screen actually rattles.
I loved that.
And it's great because you get to see grown adults with their kids, and it's the adults who are jumping back and shrieking like little kids. That's not really informational. That's more on the pure entertainment side, and honestly, it was fun. But the new museum, it's got the mix. It's got that entertainment hook there, but there's nothing quite like that. There's nothing like a jump scare. It's stuff that's teaching you, but it's doing it in a way that's fun to learn.
Makes you think.
Yeah, absolutely.
About lots of things you've read about or heard about in your life, and then it makes you, you know, we had an exhibit at one point about torture.
Yeah.
People forced to stop and consider, how do they feel about this? I mean, how do they feel about what was done? How would they do it differently? I think it just serves a wonderful role.
Tell me about when the the operation that became the core story of the books and movie Argo. When was that declassified, and how did that come to Tony and to you?
Tony was made a trailblazer. He was an initial trailblazer. They named 50 men and women in the CIA's first 50 years who made a difference, who had an impact, who left a footprint, who on and on. And because of that, the story of Argo was always kind of lurking around. Tony never meant to tell that story.
Right.
He had gone 19 years without ever saying a word about it. And it was, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm blaming George Tenet, because I think it's wonderful that the story was told. Mm-hmm. But George was the one who called Tony in and said, we're going to tell the story. We're going to declassify it. We're going to tell this story. And Tony, I don't want to say reluctantly, once it was going to happen, Tony embraced it and said, okay, you know, I'll do whatever. And the story itself came out in Wired magazine, written by a young man named Josh Bierman. Mm-hmm. And what they did with Wired magazine, this is after Tenet had freed the story up to be made public. They wrote it in Wired magazine as though it was a storyboard for a movie. And actually, on the pages of the magazine, it looked like there were little memos pinned to the page. Yeah. You could imagine that this is something in progress. Josh Bierman was a Hollywood guy, and he kind of wrote that as bait for Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And it worked, because we were sound asleep one night. Phone rang. It was our Christy Fletcher, our literary agent, and she said, George Clooney wants to buy the rights to the story. Tony's half asleep. He said, well, sell it to him. Got another call. Brad Pitt and Paramount. Mm-hmm. Tony said, double the price.
There you go.
And the next day, George Clooney had bought it.
Yeah.
Clooney was going to write the movie, the script. He was going to produce it, direct it, star in it. One other thing. I don't know. It was going to be his. Mm-hmm. But he got stuck in another movie called The Ides of March. Not a good movie. He should have just walked away. But Ben Affleck muscled his way into the movie somehow. And we think it's a good thing that he did.
The rest is history.
Yeah, he made a great movie.
Argo, it's been out long enough that, you know, we don't have to worry about big spoilers.
Yeah.
I'll save some little spoilers by just referring to one scene. When I talk to primarily agency officers, but others who know the story and then watch the movie, the most common reaction I get, other than really well done in so many ways, like unlike so many other spy movies, but that airport scene at the end, right? The decision to make it more dramatic than in a sense it needed to be, because the story automatically had so much in it. What did you make of that ending in particular?
Well, Chris Terrio was the screenwriter. Mm-hmm. That was his first script. He hadn't done that before. He had done some smaller things, but not a movie script.
Yeah.
The script actually won. There's an award, the Blackstone Award, something like that, for scripts that have been written but not yet produced, and he won that year. We talked to Chris about that, and we had no control.
Yep.
We had Chris for a week, and he knew the story backwards and forwards. Yeah. Chris said, look, my job is to make a great movie. It's an entertainment. He said, I talked to Tony, and I talked to some of the hostages, and they told me how scared they were at the end. They were just petrified. Chris said, I wanted to scare the audience to feel that same fear that you felt. You guys said you're peeking out of those little tiny airplane windows looking for F-16s that we had sold to Shah. Chris said that wasn't going to get it. And that's why he built that ending that I think everybody appreciates, that was exaggerated.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
I don't know what would have been ideal. I'm not a screenwriter, but I got to say, I've had the thought in my mind, and this will prove why I'm not a screenwriter, is I would have absolutely loved it if at the end as they're getting on the airplane, suddenly all the noise in the airport and all the cacophony that is a Tehran airport, they get on the plane and that suddenly fades as the same time that all you hear is a rising and increasingly loud and fast heartbeat. And as they're on the plane, they're looking out the window, it's dead silent, which almost never happens for an extended scene in a movie, except for the heartbeat.
I like that.
Again, Hollywood, you can call me and we'll talk. But I'm not sure that would have worked. But I got to say, it does not end the movie as well as it deserves, because the rest of it really is fantastic.
Well, you know what happens when you have that ending that is obviously fake, and I didn't ever meet anyone who said that really happened, right? No, everybody said that didn't happen, right? Yeah. Once they know that ending isn't real, then they're going to question, well, what else? What else is? Mm-hmm. What Tony did before they wrote the movie, Tony said, because they're going to make a movie, now we have to write a book.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the book Argo is Tony's unfettered memory, and it goes back to the 30-page operations report that you file after the fact. Everything that happened and didn't happen is in the book.
Yeah.
So, for instance, there is a man that he worked with whose name I'm not going to say, but his name is now public, who's come forward recently and said, I was there with him. Mm. He was. There were two people that went into Tehran.
Yeah.
If you read the book,
yeah.
Tony calls him Julio,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of, why are you calling him Julio? He wanted to call him Julio. But he was a linguist. He was there to help with the papers, and he was very valuable when he was there because it was a wrong date. And he saw it, and he fixed it. Mm-hmm. So, and the movie makes it look like, well, Tony, I think, was a hero. But it makes it look like it was just him, when, in fact, there are teams of Canadians that were the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were part of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were people back in D.C. in our offices. It's a huge team.
Yeah, really hard to make a good heroic team movie. It's been done, but of course the tendency, and I forgave that, and I still do.
Yeah.
I forgive the focus on the individual in that case. But I got to say, the book, I will also recommend the book, because the nuance in the book enriches the experience of watching the film. It really does, because it has some of those details.
I love the fact that you've read the book.
Oh, of course.
That wasn't our best-selling book. I think everybody thought, oh, I saw the movie.
Was Tony's Master of Disguise, was that one of the bestsellers? Because that one, you still see that circulating a lot.
That did very well. And if you look in The Master of Disguise, I think it's chapter 9 is the story.
Yeah.
So
the short version.
Yeah, the short version.
Yeah. So as we've moved to movies here, of course, Argo, you have a very personal connection. But I'm really curious what you think about other movies that have tried to portray some of the things you worked on. There aren't too many that do photography in the intelligence context, although Spy Game has a little bit. The Conversation has it quite a bit. But certainly on disguises. I already mentioned Mission Impossible, but of course there's TV shows like The Americans that go into disguises. What are your reactions when you see those generally, and then which specific ones really, really hit you?
You would be sad to learn that I don't watch that many spy things, because I didn't watch all of Homeland. I get irritated.
Yeah.
It's like that's not it. That's not right. Mm. But I did watch The Americans, and I watched it because I was at the museum one day, just walking through the cubicles, couldn't see the people. They're just some voices. And somebody said, Washington Post is looking for a review of The Americans. Who's watching The Americans? I said, I am. I had just started. I mean, I had seen like 3 episodes. I am.
Technically, you were watching it, yes.
They said, well, Jonna, you want to do the review? I said, sure, because that's what I say.
Yeah.
And then I went home and I watched, how many episodes were there?
Was it 6 seasons maybe?
Oh, it was just huge. Yeah. And I kept saying, no, I can't go out. I can't.
Yep.
Now I'm tied up for the weekend.
Yeah. No kidding.
I loved that show.
I mean, and disguise is a crucial part of so much of it, because, again, not giving away spoilers, because people probably should watch it, but the primary couple, the main characters, almost every episode
yeah.
have some disguise. Now,
yeah.
a lot of them are what we would call light disguises, right? You see, when you see Carrie Russell wearing a wig of a different color and slightly different 80s hairstyle, it's still Carrie Russell.
That's exactly my point of view. It's yeah. still Carrie. Yeah. She never, they didn't, I think she's so pretty. I think they didn't want to muss that up. I don't know, because they could have done so much with her, but right. he.
They did a couple of really good ones on him, where he, once I didn't recognize that it was his character and my wife punched me.
And he he inhabited his disguises. You know, he became that mousy mm-hmm. little guy, and yeah. and he was meeting with Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, ooh, he was
yes.
this handsome man. And he just got into that, and I used to use that as my example of this is
yeah.
this is what a good disguise looks like.
But that also points to what you pointed out earlier, is it's not, of course, it's about the disguise, right? The craft that goes into a really good disguise is important. But it's about training the wearer of the disguise.
How he wore it.
How to do it. And I think he really did show that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did a chief of station at one point. Is one of my favorites. He came in to my disguise lab. He was bald. Really good looking guy. Bald, bald, bald.
I respect him already.
Cowboy boots, jeans, big buckle. He wore it really well. Mm-hmm. And so I gave him a disguise, and we ended up, of course, we put a wig on him. You couldn't not. And he really liked it, but it wasn't a wig. It was a toupee, and it was like an $8,000 handmade just for him. It
wow.
was perfection. Oh. And what we did for his assignment is he wore that thing every day. And his disguise was to take it off. And when he took it off and became the bald guy, I said, in the back of your closet are some shirts that you would never wear. Somebody gave them to you. And just find his costume mm-hmm. so that when you're going to be in disguise, you've got this character and he's ready to roll. And I talked to him years later and he said, that just worked so well. That was really, really good. He said yeah. it was, you know, he became this kind of European dude.
Yeah.
Bald dude with a little bit tinted glasses. And
different cultures have different levels of shaved heads and bald men, right? But many of them, just because of aging and men, do have bald men. Is it easier in a street operational environment to have someone who is bald or has a shaved head to adopt a wig and a disguise? Or is it better to have somebody who normally has a full set of hair but suddenly goes out and has a shaved head or has a bald disguise on? Because I could see that attracting attention in some places more than a traditional disguise would.
We like a bald head walking in our door because you guys are a blank canvas. I mean,
you can do a lot with this.
What do you know? What do you want to do? You can do anything with it.
Yeah.
It's an invitation to a disguise.
Right.
Yeah. Where, I mean, otherwise, then if you've got hair under the a wig or something, and you're always worried about the edges, and these guys, they're putting these things on in parking garages in the dark. So instead, think about this. Think about a mask as just a vehicle for all the hair goods, the beard, the mustache, the wig. What if the mask is still your face, mm-hmm. which means it's really easy to make? We don't need a sculptor to change your.
Right.
So the mask is just everything will be in the right place. You just slip on the mask. You can do that in a parked car in a garage. Mm-hmm. You don't need a mirror. You get out, and it registers. Once, you know, you can just feel that, okay, it's on right.
Yeah.
That was a very cool way to go.
Going back to one of the themes that we've talked about here from the beginning as we start to wrap up, you talk a lot to people who are either entering the agency now or people who are considering it at the Spy Museum. I know one of the common questions we'll get if we're speaking is people who are considering a career in intelligence. What do you say to women who are curious about joining the CIA now, and do some of the warnings that you would have given to yourself and to others back in the day, do they still apply now, or have you come to an understanding perhaps that things are different and you give different advice than you would have?
I talked to a senior CIA woman last week. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to do something together, and she was telling me that her daughter, I think her daughter is 40. Mm-hmm. Her daughter sat down with her the other day and said, you know, Mom, I understand what you went through and what those women went through, but it's not like that now. It's way better. Just because you're a woman doesn't mean that they discount your opinion, that they won't listen to you. That this daughter was telling her mother that she thinks that that has changed. Well, I haven't had the experience. I don't know that things have changed. Mm-hmm. I know that women at CIA have seemed to, I think you mentioned earlier in this talk, on the seventh floor, they've always been great. Directors, mm-hmm. executives, the women have always had their act together up there. I don't know why that is. Yeah. But at the working level, I don't have a good sense of it. I used to think that it would be men who would have to change. And I was always waiting to meet the next generation. They were going to come in. They were going to be enlightened. They were going to be, oh, yeah, of course, you, right. Here, do this. What I think has happened is that women have changed. Young women have changed. And they're not as quiet and as malleable as we were. They go in, they have expectations. And if the CIA isn't going to meet those expectations, they'll go have them met elsewhere. I think that kind of an attitude on the part of women is going to serve them really, really well. Mm-hmm. I think there are incredible careers waiting at the CIA for women to come in and fill them. You know, there are pieces of it like the analytical piece of it. Women have done well in analysis. Mm-hmm. Our technical women in science and technology have done well. It's the murky spot in the CIA was always in the operational piece of it.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the women, when I was there, we were still figuring out how to earn their respect, where we would be really treated as equals. There were all these peripheral things out there, like, well, in the Middle East, you know, being a woman is going to be an issue. Or different parts of the world, being a woman was going to be an issue. It turns out it wasn't, you know?
Be an operational asset in many ways.
That's my point of view. I don't apologize for being a woman. Use it. Mm-hmm. It's a strength. It can be a strength. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's still forming and reforming. Yeah. I'm not there anymore, but...
Yeah. How important was it to you to see women in every senior role of the agency a few years ago? I mean, you'd had an executive director, the de facto number three. Now I think they call it chief operating officer, or chief exec, something like that. But the deputy directors of operations, analysis, S&T, digital innovation. And then to see a woman case officer rise to become director, What do you think, seeing that every major leadership role has now had a woman in it?
When I would give a talk, mm-hmm. I would go through what you just went through. I would mm-hmm. make sure that people understood that the women at that organization were basically running it, and have been for some time.
Yeah,
women mm-hmm. have been represented quite well. Mm-hmm. But that was never the piece that I was having an issue with. Mm. You know, my mom worked at Boeing when I was coming up. She worked in computers. I was in Wichita, the airplane capital of the world. And my mom would be routinely laid off by Boeing because they'd lose a government contract, so they'd cut back on personnel. My mom would be sent home. She was in computers. Then they'd get a new contract. They'd hire my mom back. Now she's working for the men she was training when she was. And this was her career.
A cycle,
And I kind of watched it out of the corner of my eye as I was coming up. And that's how it was. And it wasn't just Boeing. That's how it was everywhere.
Yeah.
So we've come a long ways, I think, from that kind of blatant discrimination. Not so blatant anymore, but I think it's still there. I did not write this book to write about discrimination against women. I set out to write a memoir of my career. It was just very simple. I kind of wandered into this subject and couldn't, no matter where I turned, couldn't get away from it and had to include it. And then even wider outside of the CIA, talking about people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how important she was, or even Eloise, who came up way before I was there. But it's a subject that won't lay down and go to sleep.
Yeah. Well, I've asked you many questions here today, but it is time for our chatterbox to ask you a question. It will do so in my voice, however, because we have not yet trained it to have realistic speech. This is interesting. Hopefully you've watched enough movies that this one will work. Who played the best James Bond?
The most recent one.
Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig.
Why?
You know, the first time I saw him was a still photo, and I looked at his photo and I said, that's not James Bond. Everything about him was wrong.
Yeah.
Because he's not the most charming, but James Bond, the charm was superficial. Yeah. This guy was so real. It was visceral. He just seemed to me like he would do almost anything to do his job, and I thought that was real. He was not above doing a little sneaking around and a little bit of I don't know, everything yeah. about him just really appealed to me. I liked all the rest of them. There wasn't one I didn't. Well, David Niven, I didn't think he didn't really have it. Pierce Brosnan was pretty wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's been a group of really wonderful men, but I thought Daniel Craig was, and the fact that he is no longer James Bond still gives me grief.
Yeah. I'm so curious. At least last time I looked, they haven't announced who will be next, and there's so many issues that are coming up around that now.
Maybe they're going to have him come back on contract.
Oh, that would
kind
be
of a green badge.
What?
Think about it.
I'm like, what a trick to pull on us.
Wouldn't
right?
that be
the
something?
Big surprise is actually, I don't know if they could keep it secret until they release the film, but if they could, that would be wonderful.
Let's write that up and send it to the Broccoli family.
There we go.
We have a plan for you.
There's our hook.
And for Daniel.
Yeah. Well, it'll give him something to do because I'm sure he has no other offers to do work. We don't want him just sitting back and drinking pina coladas on the beach with nothing to do. Jonna, thank you. This has been a personal pleasure and hopefully really interesting for people to hear about your experiences and to hear about at least some of the stories, not nearly all of them, in your new book, In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I loved it.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter @ThatWasChatter.